Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again and welcome back to As It Is. We come to you every day from the Voice of America in Washington to help you learn and improve your American English. We present interesting stories from around the world by using words that are easy to understand. And we speak slowly so you can follow along without missing important words or thoughts. Today we have two stories for you. The first is about a special visitor to this country, but it's not a person. Then, technology helped some Australians to keep their area clean and free from ugly paint marks. If you are ready, let's listen and learn with part one. A warship from France that came to the United States 235 years ago became a sign of friendship between the two countries. The French ship traveled across the Atlantic Ocean to help defeat the British during the American Revolutionary War. Now, a full-scale replica, a reproduction of the ship, has made that same trip. It is traveling along the U.S. East Coast through the middle of July. Katie Weaver has details as she remembers a special day in American history.
On July 4, 1776, 13 British colonies in North America announced their independence from Great Britain. At the time, the colonies were at war with Britain. The fighting ended in 1783. When the British recognized America's independence. The Americans might have lost the war if it were not for a French warship called the Hermione. The ship crossed the Atlantic to help the American forces. The replica of the Hermione is called the Freedom Frigate. The replica looks like the warship seen in old paintings. It is 65 meters long and 56 meters high. About 80 people are working on the ship. Aurore Le Villain is with the mostly French volunteer crew. She admits she had to deal with her fear of heights. At sea, she says, the waves are likely to carry a sailor from one side of the ship to another. Alice Brew, another crew member, says she had never sailed before she joined the Freedom Frigate.
We have more than 200 different ropes, and each has a different use, and it's also physically difficult because everything is heavy.
The story of the Hermione begins with a friendship between George Washington and the Marquis de Lafayette. Washington was the commander of the American armies. He later became the first president of the United States. The Marquis de Lafayette was a young French aristocrat who was an army volunteer. Lafayette returned to France to get ships and troops to help the Americans. He sailed back on the Hermione to help fight the British troops. Shipbuilders in France spent 17 years building the replica. Con Goynich went to see the ship during its visit to the port of Alexandria, Virginia. He noted how the shipbuilders used many methods from the 18th century to rebuild the Hermione. He added that the guns were made at the same factory that made guns for the Hermione and the French Navy in the 1770s. Bruno Gravalier is the superintendent on the replica. He says the ship is as real or authentic as possible. But he says there are a few additions, such as an engine, that make it safer than the old warship. Adam Hodges LeClaire is a history student and one of the few Americans on the crew. He says that the ship feels crowded, just like it used to be.
You have moments when people are very close. Potentially you need some space. At the same time, it's nice to have that support whenever you're doing a maneuver.
Miles Young is president of a group called the Friends of Hermione Lafayette in America.
This is one of the symbolic journeys of freedom in history. Celebrates the birth of the United States as a free and independent nation.
He adds that the Hermione will also show the importance of freedom around the world. I'm Katie Weaver.
This is VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Cities throughout the world spend a lot of money fighting graffiti. Graffiti writers leave their mark in public places, often on walls or other surfaces. They spray paint words, artwork, or other things on buildings, trains, and buses. Some graffiti writers even damage statues. Efforts by police to stop the writers often fail. Officials in Australia have begun using a new technology that can recognize the most commonly used graffiti materials, paint and marker pens. They hope it will help police stop people from defacing walls on the passenger areas of trains. Bob Doty tells us more.
Some passenger trains in Sydney, Australia, are covered in graffiti. Surveillance cameras help police officers stop those who illegally write on train cars. But there are just too many cars in the system. Police and railroad officials cannot watch all of the cameras all the time. Last year, Sydney Trains, the operator of the city's rail service, began using a new surveillance system that has an electronic nose. Howard Collins is the head of Sydney Trains.
We've had 50 people being charged with offences, and as we roll it out now to other trains, it's proving even more successful.
The device is called Mousetrap. It was developed by Technique Risk, an Australian company. Mousetrap can identify gases released by markers and spray paints. Mark Byers founded the company. He says when the device recognizes the smell of graffiti, it sends a message to an alarm, which is connected to a nearby surveillance camera.
The strength of the system is the fact that the security personnel or police can monitor the system in the field with a mobile phone. The information that they receive is the train or the carriage number, the location that the event is occurring, and also where that train is going to.
Graffiti writers cannot disable the system because the sensor is hidden in the wall of the train car. Police guard the trains and train stations. Many of the officers look like passengers. They can quickly react when Mousetrap tells them someone is painting on the walls. Howard Collins says the system keeps a record of where and when graffiti writers are working. He says this can help officials decide where to deploy officers.
Now we're building a profile of where and when these incidents occur. So the police already have the intelligence and the information to say, this is where this is likely to occur, and this is the time of day.
Mr. Collins says Mousetrap has worked so well that most of Sydney's trains are now free of graffiti. He says it cost about $500,000 to put the system in place, But he says that is not a lot of money compared to the $34 million Sydney Trains spent last year to remove graffiti. I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to As It Is from the Learning English Department of VOA, the Voice of America, Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. Prices on China's stock markets have dropped by about a third in the past few weeks. This week, the Chinese government warned investors about what it called a panic sentiment. The government has introduced new measures it hopes will stop weeks of declining prices. In an effort to avoid further losses, hundreds of companies listed on China's stock exchanges filed papers for trading suspensions on Wednesday. Trading in the stocks of more than 1,300 mainland companies had been suspended. That is about 40% of the market. The country's central bank promised to, in its words, offer abundant liquidity supply for security brokers. That means it would make loans to brokers to make sure they have enough money to carry out trades. And the government moved to permit insurance companies to invest large amounts of money in stocks. The government agency that oversees the country's biggest state-run companies told them not to sell shares. Instead, it told them to buy more, to keep the market stable. The amount of stock market value lost since prices began to drop is about $3.2 trillion. China's Securities Regulatory Commission blamed the losses partly on a panic sentiment and irrational selling. In recent days, the government put in place a number of measures to support stock buying. These include reducing interest rates, lowering the fees charged to buy and sell stocks, and easing rules on how much money traders must deposit in order to buy stocks. China's stock market measures increased in late 2014 after the central bank cut interest rates for the first time in more than 2 years. A new trading link between the Shanghai and Hong Kong exchanges added to market activity. Higher margin trading, in which investors do not have to deposit the full cost of their stock trades in order to buy the shares, also fueled gains. In the 12 months before June 12th of this year, the total value of stocks traded on the Chinese market increased by more than 150%. But as the market peaked in early June, the government tightened rules on margin trading. Investors then began to sell their holdings to protect their profits. China's central bank has reacted to the market drop by trying to limit the losses. Chen Jiahe is an expert at Cinda Securities in Shanghai. In his words, the government's main objective is to prevent share prices from slumping further amid a selling stampede. But another expert, Mark Williams of Capital Economics, said there is a good chance that efforts to rescue the market may not succeed. And that's the VOA Learning English Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we look back at Bill Clinton's second term as president.
For 4 years now, to realize our vision, we have pursued a simple but profound strategy. Opportunity for all. Responsibility from all. A strong, united American community.
Americans elected Clinton as their 42nd president in 1992 and re-elected him 4 years later. In the summer of 1996, President Clinton's first term was coming to an end. He had established a mixed record of successes and failures in his dealings with Congress. He had greater difficulty in those dealings after opposition Republicans won control of Congress in 1994. All presidents face political battles, but in President Clinton's case, there was more to it. He and his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton, were being investigated over their personal financial dealings in Arkansas during the 1980s. There were also accusations of womanizing from his years as governor of that state. But in the summer of 96, President Clinton's public approval ratings stayed above 50% and went as high as 60%. The economy had improved during his first term. Americans were getting jobs and spending more money. More people, and not just the wealthy, were investing in the stock market. In August of 1996, the Democratic Party met in Chicago and nominated President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore for a second term.
My fellow Democrats and my fellow Americans, thank you for your nomination. I don't know if I can find a fancy way to say this, but I accept.
The Republican Party held its nominating convention that summer in San Diego, California. The party chose former Kansas Senator Bob Dole as its presidential candidate. He had resigned from the United States Senate to seek the nomination. He chose former Congressman and Cabinet Secretary Jack Kemp of New York as his vice presidential running mate. Dole was a World War II hero who suffered a permanent injury to his right arm. He later served 4 terms in the House of Representatives. He was elected to the Senate in 1968 and re-elected 4 times. Another candidate in the presidential race was businessman Ross Perot. He won the nomination of the Reform Party, which he started a year earlier. He had also run for president in 1992 and received 19% of the popular vote. During the 96 campaign, President Clinton pointed to the stronger economy. He also campaigned on his legislative record, including new gun control measures and a higher minimum wage for the lowest paid workers. Bob Dole, in his campaign, accused President Clinton of spending too much. Clinton's answer was that he had stopped Congress from cutting too much from programs like health insurance for retirees. Bill Clinton and Al Gore easily won the election, defeating Bob Dole and Jack Kent. Ross Perot received just 8% of the popular vote this time. Clinton became the first Democrat to win a second term since Franklin Roosevelt in 1936. William Jefferson Clinton began his second term as President of the United States on January 20, 1997. His inaugural speech would be the last by an American president in the 20th century.
Let us lift our eyes toward the challenges that await us in the next century. It is our great good fortune that time and chance have put us not only at the edge of a new century in a new millennium, but on the edge of a bright new prospect in human affairs, a moment that will define our course and our character for decades to come. We must keep our old democracy forever young.
Clinton discussed some of the issues that the country continued to face, including racial divisions.
The divide of race has been America's constant curse. And each new wave of immigrants gives new targets to old prejudices. Prejudice and contempt cloaked in the pretense of religious or political convictions are no different.
During his first term, President Clinton appointed a large number of women and minorities to the government. As he began his second term, he chose the first woman to serve as Secretary of State. Madeleine Albright had represented the United States in the United Nations during Clinton's first term. And he appointed the first Asian American to serve in the cabinet. Norman Mineta became Secretary of Commerce. The Republican Party kept control of both houses of Congress in the 1996 elections. At the end of his first term, Clinton had gotten into a budget fight with the Republicans, which resulted in two government shutdowns. Those shutdowns did more political harm to the Republicans than to the president. In 1997, they reached a compromise. They agreed to a plan to end the federal deficit by 2002. In fact, the budget was balanced much sooner. In 1998, the economy was so strong that the government found itself with an extra $70 billion, the first surplus since 1969. President Clinton visited China in 1998. He spoke of his belief that in the 21st century, democracy will be the right course practically as well as morally, yielding more stability and more progress. A month later, in August of 1998, Al-Qaeda terrorists bombed the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. The attacks killed more than 200 people. President Clinton ordered missile strikes against Al-Qaeda targets in Sudan and in Afghanistan in an effort to kill the group's leader, Osama bin Laden. Later in the year, President Clinton ordered military action in response to Iraq's refusal to cooperate with United Nations inspectors. The inspectors were searching for nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. Clinton ordered missile strikes against targets that UN officials said could have been linked to such weapons of mass destruction.
Their mission is to attack Iraq's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs and its military capacity to threaten its neighbors. Their purpose is to protect the national interest of the United States and indeed the interests of people throughout the Middle East and around the world. Saddam Hussein must not be allowed to threaten his neighbors or the world with nuclear arms, poison gas, or biological weapons.
In 1999, Clinton deployed American aircraft and missiles as part of a NATO campaign in Yugoslavia. NATO was trying to stop attacks against ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. Yugoslav military leaders agreed to withdraw their troops. NATO stopped the bombing and sent an international peacekeeping force to Kosovo. The United States provided 7,000 troops for that force. Earlier in Clinton's presidency, the United States had led NATO airstrikes against Serb targets in the former Yugoslav Republic of Bosnia. The operations followed the killing of 8,000 Muslim men and boys by Bosnian Serb forces in Srebrenica, a UN-declared safe area. Clinton later pushed for the 1995 peace agreement to end the Bosnian War. The Dayton Peace Accords were named after Dayton, Ohio, the location of the Air Force base where they were negotiated. 3 years later, in 1998, Israeli and Palestinian leaders signed a Memorandum of Understanding at the White House. It called for Israeli forces to withdraw from some areas of the West Bank. The Y Memorandum resulted from 9 days of negotiations at the Y River Plantation in Maryland. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Special Diplomat Dennis Ross traveled repeatedly to the Middle East to work on the peace efforts. In 2001, President Clinton tried to get Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak to sign a peace agreement. Clinton invited the two leaders to the United States and held many hours of talks with them. Reports said they came close to an agreement, but the negotiations ended without success. Palestinians declared a new uprising against Israel. On trade issues, President Clinton, at the end of his second term, got Congress to approve permanent normal trade relations with China. That meant no more need for presidents to have to ask Congress for temporary renewals of those trade rights. Clinton argued that the move would create a better environment for democratic reforms in China, as well as creating jobs in the United States. Among other foreign policy matters during his presidency, Clinton normalized relations with Vietnam, and he supported the expansion of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, in Europe. Bill Clinton's presidency will be remembered, at least in part, for his efforts to reach out to the international community. But it will also be remembered for the impeachment trial in Congress that almost ended that presidency.
These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people.
That will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.